Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. President Obama has spoken at the United Nations General Assembly for the final time, delivering a speech that focused heavily on refugees and the need for world leaders to do more to tackle the issue. But what about shouldering responsibility for the major role that the United States has played in creating the refugee crisis through its endless wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and its drive to overthrow the existing government in Syria? Was President Obama's speech merely window dressing? And how does Obama want the world to remember him as he prepares to exit the world stage in less than 4 months? We are joined from Moscow by Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk, and from Tulsa by Jeremy Kuzmarov, professor of American history at the University of Tulsa, whose latest book is Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century. In our first segment, we will be joined by Loud and Clear producer Walter Smolarek, and in the second and third segments by editorial cartoonist Ted Rall. Welcome, Peter, Jeremy, and Walter.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Peter Lavelle, President Obama spent a big part of the opening in his speech on the need to promote and accelerate what he called integration, economic integration, or globalization. He was wrapping it as the driver of progress. And, you know, he has an agenda, and the agenda is to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, an agreement that obviously could not pass before the November election, but which may be and will be, in fact, introduced to the Congress for an up or down vote after the election and when the politicians aren't really accountable to the electorate. Were you surprised by the emphasis on globalization? And what does it say about the real role of the United States in the world economy? President Obama said, it's all about protecting unions. It's all about protecting the environment. That's why this trade agreement is so wonderful.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Number one, there's not one thing that he can really call an achievement in his presidency in foreign policy, with the possible exception of the nuclear deal with Iran, which I applaud, and it was long overdue. But the United States hasn't implemented its side of the deal. So why did he give so much stress to globalization and the global economy? Well, what he's proposing, his administration is proposing as it leaves office, is what major corporations want to see the world economy look like. I find it so incredibly untruthful in a way that he cannot claim to have anything under his belt. I mean, I didn't, unfortunately, didn't get to see the speech, but I was parsing all through the sound bites, and it's a world turned upside down. I find it really, truly incredible, and I know we'll talk about Syria later. So I've always called him the commander in speech. It was a nice speech, but it was completely disconnected from reality on every single issue that the U.S. president mentioned.
I hear you, and that's the voice of Peter Lavelle. He is the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk. Jeremy, let's turn to you. President Obama said, this is again in the opening, our international order has been so successful that we take it as a given that great powers no longer fight world wars, that the end of the Cold War lifted the shadow of nuclear Armageddon, that the battlefields of Europe have been replaced by peaceful union. Tell us from your point of view about this international order. Has it been successful? Are catastrophes like world wars really things of the past?
Well, I think that's an excellent statement about what Peter was saying, because in a case where Obama's disingenuous, because on the nuclear issue, he's done a complete about face. Yeah, he gives very nice speeches, and perhaps it wins over some people. But if you look at the reality, he did an about face in order to $1 trillion nuclear modernization program. And William J. Perry, the former defense secretary, himself has warned that the danger of nuclear war is greater now than even during the height of the Cold War. And this is from a long statement standing Cold Warrior. So I think that's very disingenuous. And I think, yeah, we see that Obama in many ways did carry the torch of George W. Bush and promoted a lot of military actions that have yielded terrible consequences of destabilizing countries like in the Middle East, like with Libya, for instance, is a good case in point that's making the world much more dangerous than it previously was. So I agree that there's a lot of disingenuousness. And the world order today, I think, is a very scary one.
Okay, Walter Smolarek, I want to come back to the Middle East. I want to come back to Europe. I want to come back to U.S.-Russian relations. I want to come back to what President Obama said about Ukraine. But I want to still stay right now on the opening with the TPP, because that's what he was doing. He was pitching the TPP. He was wrapping it as a vision for economic progress, a motor for progress. Of course, he can't get it through Congress unless it's done in a lame duck session. Talk about the TPP. It looks like it's dead. Nobody will support it. Hillary Clinton, who called it at one time the gold standard of trade deals. Is it a trade deal?
Well, these types of agreements are really more like investor bill of rights than they are trade deals. It was pretty remarkable how much time President Obama devoted to defending the TPP and sort of the neoliberal ideology behind it. I mean, it sounded, you know, it was a very ideological speech at the beginning, and then it sort of dawns on you that it's really all leading up to this punchline about, you know, this is why the TPP needs to pass. Clearly, he sees it as a major part of his legacy as the president. But of course, what the TPP is really about, it's not about bringing people together and ensuring the rule of law and strong unions. It's preventing or removing any types of barriers that corporations will face when it comes to investing in other countries.
Corporations can actually sue governments. In other words, governments that are democratically elected by the people can be sued by corporations, because those corporations can assert that the policies of the government, either to defend the environment or labor rights or whatever indigenous industry, have somehow impeded the maximizing of those corporate profits. That becomes actually a crime under the TPP.
Right. And that's a principle, that's a thing called the investor state dispute settlement system, which are basically these kangaroo courts where corporate lawyers, literally lawyers who spend most of their lives or their time defending corporations in actual courts, serve as judges on these panels that hear claims brought by corporations against states when they feel that these policies have impeded their profitability to one degree or another. For instance, Philip Morris sued Uruguay for, I believe, $25 million for implementing WHO recommended policies to prevent the widespread addiction to tobacco products.
Yeah, that's right. Peter, go ahead.
I completely agree with what we just heard, and I'm glad your guest there knows the details better than I do. But more broadly, and I think we can talk about this in other areas of the speech, it's the Americanization of international law. This is really quite extraordinary. This is what he's pushing here. The extension is also, when we had the recent NATO summit in Warsaw, it was slipped under the rug. Hardly ever any Western media mentioned it, but the European Union and NATO are now one. They are united. What does that mean? That's a Trojan horse. Okay, of course the United States cannot make intricate deals or control on the European Union on a political level, but if you put their defenses and their security into the pockets of Washington, you've made them essentially benign. And we see this going on with the dispute with the Philippines had with China going to the UN Convention of the Seas. The United States is not even a member of that convention, but it pushed the Filipinos to use that convention and other proxies they have in the Pacific. And broadly speaking, if you look at everything he talked about, it is the globalization of the American political order to the advantage of the American political order and its proxies and allies around the world. This is the true legacy of Barack Obama beyond all of the catastrophes. And you've been on my program many times, Brian. We've talked about them over and over again. So I think it is really interesting that you start out with this, because that is the kind of legacy he wants. And let's keep in mind, that speech was to the political and economic and financial establishment of the United States, not to the United Nations. Let's keep that in mind.
Excellent point, because I think President Obama, and this happens frequently in the presentation of globalization or integration, economic integration, as he called it, it's considered to be something neutral, something automatic, a new stage of technological or economic development. and not driven by vested interests, not driven by U.S. interests in terms of securing domination. Jeremy, one of the issues that President Obama mentioned on this score, he said, well, after the Soviet Union was no more in the last 25 years, after the end of the Cold War, there has also been an attempt to have a new kind of world order. And he said the United States is special. He didn't say it's exceptional, but it was more or less going in that direction. He said the only country that really is after empire is Russia. Now, that blew my mind because, you know, the United States has 1,000 military bases around the world. The United States last weekend dropped bombs, drone strikes in 6 different countries. No other country does that. But he says Russia is the only last vestige, the echo of the phenomena of empire in the world. And then, of course, he said it's because Russia trying to regain its lost glory. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, I think you have the historic denial of empire. The term is even in academia, you know, few academics want to use the term empire, and then they're always attacked for being Marxists or on the left if they use it. So there's just a kind of denial at play, which is, yeah, very convenient for a country that is, as you mentioned, has all these military bases and has behaved in many ways. Well, yeah, since the end of the Cold War, they've been unconstrained because there's no rival or power capable of constraining them in any way. And that's what we've seen in the last 25 years of history of American unilateralism. And it's led to many excesses and overreaches and a lot of chaos in our world, as we've all pointed out. So, and I think, yeah, the TPP is also part of, speaking about Obama's legacy, is part of his pivot to Asia policy designed to recruit some of these countries into the American orbit to undercut Chinese power and influence in Southeast Asia. And that bodes a lot of danger. As I know, for somebody who studied history of conflicts like the Korean and Vietnam Wars, which were in some ways proxy wars, what we see going on is very dangerous, this pivot strategy and this rivalry with the Chinese, where it could lead in the future.
Yeah, Walter Smolarek, President Obama said, we've made institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund more inclusive. I mean, these were the two pillars. The third was the United Nations, the pillar of the post-World War II world order that the United States created, whereby it took its allies like Britain or France to some degree and its enemies, Germany and Japan, and brought them together in a global united front under the leadership of the United States. But have the World Bank and the IMF been reformed? Are they more inclusive? And as Jeremy was talking about, isn't the TPP really an effort to really sabotage China's growing influence, including even in Asia, in its own backyard?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the world order is profoundly undemocratic, and the World Bank and the IMF are central pillars of it. So, no, I mean, I don't think by any stretch of the imagination the IMF or the World Bank could now be considered to be more inclusive institutions. I mean, there was the inclusion of the Chinese currency in the special drawing rights basket that the IMF uses. But of course, that's something that was resisted by the United States to the very end. I mean, there's still an arrangement where the World Bank is always headed by an American and the IMF always headed by a European, not exactly a democratic thing for people in the rest of the world. And the TPP being part of a geopolitical strategy, I think, is definitely correct. You know, China has supported the launch of alternative international institutions, financial and otherwise. There's the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is a rival to the Asian Development Bank, dominated by Japan, a key U.S. and Western ally. Really a key part of the Western, if you want to use that term, world order that was implemented at the end of World War II. And, you know, there are also other alternative institutions, the IMF and World Bank, that the United States has been resisting. There's the contingent reserve arrangement that the BRICS announced at their Fortaleza summit in Brazil. There's the New Development Bank. You know, the U.S. views all these things, all these challenges to their fully undemocratic world order as a serious threat. And the TPP is part of the pushback against this sort of the rising of alternative centers of power in the world.
Peter Lavelle, go ahead.
I think it's absolutely fascinating and absolutely correct. And I think it explains something very important that I think our listeners should be aware of. When you look at all of these initiatives, creating Russia as a threat to the West, which I live here, it's just absolutely laughable. I mean, people here are just bewildered to no end about the amount of propaganda being churned out in the West. And then we talk about these trade agreements. It's really Obama, his entire foreign policy in his 8 years, and it shows a country in a hurry, in a hurry. We can look at Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, creating a threat out of Russia, pushing back against the Chinese. The Americans know, the American political elite and the deep state knows that the window of opportunity is closing, and it's closing a lot faster than they expected. And I think this is what's making this very activist foreign policy in every single dimension, because you have China is a power of unbelievable strength to reckon with. Russia has made sure under Putin's time in office, and we've talked about this before, Brian, two pillars of Putin's policy is to make Russia strong and sovereign. And this is something that is not liked at all in Washington. And this is one of the reasons why there is so much hostility towards Russia. You can sanction it. You can call it names. You can call its leader a villain. And it doesn't have much effect. And oh, by the way, Russia, too, can exert power abroad if and when necessary, but under international law. So it's, I think it's, all of this stuff is very much connected. And I think Obama, if he's aware of it or not, has really just told us. And we, you know, all four of us here talking have seen through the behind the veil, as it were, about what he was talking about. And I think, again, I'm really glad that you brought up this first issue, because I think it ties everything together.
That is the voice of Peter Lavelle. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We are joined from Moscow by Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk, and from Tulsa by Jeremy Kuzmarov, a professor of American history at the University of Tulsa, and by political cartoonist Ted Rall. We're talking about President Obama's final speech at the United Nations. Before we took a break, Peter Lavelle, we were talking about how President Obama is presenting the new world order as if it's something benign, something neutral, not driven by American interests. But at one time, at one point in his speech, he actually was explicit about this. He said the United States is a superpower, but it's unique in world history because its role in world politics is not driven by its own narrow vested interests. I mean, wow. Talk about that.
It's like you're trying to convince me the moon is made of cheese. It is so divorced from reality. I think if you were to ask the people of the greater Middle East, if you were to ask Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, the United States is a benign power. That is truly extraordinary. What really gets me is that they talk about values all of the time and how the world needs to emulate American values. But even those same values, the right to not be oppressed by your own government, when you have governments that the United States supports all around the world that are very, very oppressive. Hillary Clinton takes millions and millions of dollars from Saudi Arabia and then says that part of her foreign policy agenda would be to protect gay people. I mean, we could spend hours and hours going through every single point. The spread of democracy. Well, Hezbollah wins an election, but that's wrong. The people of Eastern Ukraine want to express their self-determination, but it's wrong. The Egyptian people voted the wrong way. I mean, it defies common sense when you listen to the president of the United States saying that the United States is benign and its values will make the world peaceful and prosperous. It's just ludicrous.
Ted Rall, one of the points of President Obama's speech at the UN was to decry, denounce, condemn the rise of sectarianism or excessive nationalism or tribalism or racism. And he was pointing specifically to the Middle East. But oddly, he did not take responsibility for the United States' role in that sort of fragmentation of that region.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. I mean, obviously, sectarianism really broke out after the deposal of Saddam Hussein, which happened, obviously, at the hands of the United States in Iraq, and now by the civil war in Syria, both cases secular socialist leaders who were able to keep a lid on these secular divisions in Islam and other religions out there. So, yeah, I wouldn't say it's odd. You know, it's much like the question about the idea of American values. There's something very American. It's part of our American political and culture and self-identity that we don't, not only do we do what we want, but we claim that we are doing it because for the greater good. We're a benevolent, good-loving people. We don't do things that are we're not jerks. You're not going to see this among other. If you just look historically in the past, for example, you know, you didn't have, Adolf Hitler didn't argue to the German people that he wanted to occupy all of Europe for the good of all of Europe. He said that it was for the good of just the German people, and at that rate, only for some German people, not all German people, not minorities and Jews and so on. So, but here in the U.S., we have this fiction that somehow Americans can only really feel okay about themselves if they feel like their government is not really doing the things that we all know that we do. It's cognitive dissonance, and at some point, you know, it's just going to break down, but it hasn't happened yet.
Jeremy, I want to ask you the same question. You're a historian. You have looked at the Vietnam War, the Korean War. I mean, since World War II, the United States has been in one war after another. Every generation was called on to fight, even though the United States mainland was not under attack. Certainly, of course, there was the attack on September 11, 2001, but that's not exactly the same thing as having a military march on your borders. The last time that happened was the War of 1812. Talk about how President Obama's presentation would be viewed at the General Assembly, because you have the whole world there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does fit a historical pattern. I do think I have studied the British Empire, and I think the British also claim that their adventures all around the world were necessary to bring stability. And you do hear these kind of tropes among some other empires, yeah, perhaps not the Nazis. But yeah, I think Obama just sounds like every other U.S. president. Yeah, perhaps it's in the cultural DNA, as Mr. Roll suggested, that the American leader has to get up there and say, we're great and we do everything for good. When the record is often quite the opposite. So I think he's just following the precedent, and it's nothing new. Yeah, every war that the U.S. has waged has always been seemingly for altruistic purposes, and we know that there are often hidden agendas, and that thousands or even millions of people get killed. So unfortunately, yeah, it's a pattern we see in history.
Peter Lavelle, President Obama just went to Laos. He said, well, he wishes people around the world knew more about what happened in Laos. But the reason they don't know more is it was a secret war. It went on for 10 years. The United States dropped more bombs on Laos, that little country, than all the bombs that were dropped on Japan and Germany combined in World War II. And the United States, President Obama said, hey, here's $90 million to clean it up.
Yeah, well, it's talked about... Has the United States ever compensated the people of Vietnam for Agent Orange? No. And most people only know Agent Orange because of a punk rock band in the 1970s. I'd like to go back to the question you asked, Jeremy, because I think it's so very important. How do I think the audience at the General Assembly accepted it? I think they probably all laugh up their sleeves, but they can't say it publicly because they're client states. They're too many client states, and they will be punished. Look at the drive to war in 2003, the illegal war against Iraq, the arm twisting, the threats, the bribery to get people on board in the United Nations to back these resolutions. I mean, it was really hard stuff. I mean, Stalin would be proud. And so I think that sitting in that audience there, it's very much like when Obama was in Brussels. I think it was a year and a half, 2 years ago. And he gave the same kind of, claptrap speech. And when he finished, everyone in the audience was just bewildered. Did he actually really say all that stuff? One person clapped, and it was part of his own detail. One person clapped, and then he walked off stage. And I don't know if he was oblivious to it or not. I mean, well, I don't know if we'll ever know how much he really believes of what he's saying. I'm not saying, well, Barack Obama's a bad person, but this is what is expected of the president of the United States now. This is exactly, it's to support the interests, and I will use the term again, of the deep state. And the rhetoric is to cover it up. It's sugarcoating. And just like we heard earlier, is that it makes everybody feel good, because all of us are interested in politics here. But the average person in America, how much foreign news do they get on a daily basis, a weekly basis? It's scant.
Yeah. Ted Rall, I was watching President Obama speak on the UN web camera. And while he was talking, the camera went to the Syrian ambassador to the UN, because he was talking about the rise of ISIL, Daesh, the so-called Islamic State in Syria, and then did not say anything about the prospects for ending the threat presented by ISIL by offering, say, a real united front with the main army that's actually been doing the bulk of the fighting and dying against ISIL or against Al-Qaeda or al-Nusra or the Army of Conquest. And of course, that would be the Syrian Arab Army. When you think about what he's talking about, how to tamp down or defeat or degrade or restrict or restrain the rise of extremism in the Middle East, and not talk about U.S. policy or the need for a change in U.S. policy.
Well, that's right, because obviously there is no intention to change U.S. policy. So all that he has to offer are meaningless words. And that's all you've got. I mean, you know, another thing that might have been mentioned in that same breath, which never would have been, would be the fact that a very fragile ceasefire was broken by the U.S. in Syria just a couple of days ago, and with a bombing that went awry and that was aimed at ISIS and apparently hit Syrian National Army troops instead. But that's beside the point. The point is that there was a ceasefire, and the U.S. broke the ceasefire. The whole Syria situation is something that is owned by this administration, and the rise of ISIS is certainly in part the product of the U.S.'s decision to arm what was then called the Free Syrian Army, a part of which became ISIS, and to fund them, and to put some boots on the ground, some training, some CIA trainers. And you know, we're living with the consequences of that now. And, you know, I mean, I just wanted to mention, just to say, point out one thing, you know, well, I don't want to say that, you know, President Obama is a bad person. Here, I'll say it. He's a bad person. I mean, you know, the odds are that right before he walked over to the UN to give that speech, he was coordinating a drone strike in Pakistan or Yemen that killed innocent people, thousands of whom have died there. I'm sorry, if you kill thousands of people, yeah, you're a bad person, you know?
Let me react to that.
Go ahead, Peter.
I see your point. I see your point exactly, and from that vantage point, you're absolutely right. My point is that I think that there's such a disconnect between separating what happens on the ground and what you are told in briefings in an air-conditioned office, the Oval Office, and it is presented in such a benign way that we're doing the right thing. This is the most important thing. We have to bring, I think they actually believe we have to bring a Western-style democracy to Syria. And that's how they justify it all. So, you know, agreeing and disagreeing, it's part of that entire mindset. You know, my father fought in the Second World War in the Pacific, and he was at Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And I can remember during the Reagan administration, it was Iran-Contra and everything. And he said to me, what they're saying about America is wrong. We've never done anything wrong to anyone in the world. And he said that with a straight face. And it's so built into the DNA of American political culture, and the mass media, the corporate media reinforces it over and over again. So I just doubt what level of cognitive knowledge Obama has when it comes to his decisions and then the later consequences.
That was Peter Lavelle. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, I would just say, I think these leaders make a devil's bargain. They get all the trappings of power, and they serve just as a kind of figurehead for the interests that control the government and want these militant policies. And Obama's just a figurehead, and he's done his job very well because he's an eloquent speaker, unlike Bush, who is a bumbler. So he's made that devil's bargain, and he lives a great life. That's my view of him.
But is the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, just a figurehead? And if so, you know, who's the captain of the ship then? Because I hear you that there's a broader institutional power. If the president of the United States gets sick or dies, or, you know, there's a system of replacement. And of course, there is the professional operations of the state. But President Obama has a lot of influence. I mean, he has a whole lot of influence. He could have bombed Syria in August, September 2013, when his Secretary of State was demanding it, when the media was demanding it, when the Washington Post was demanding it. He didn't really have a lot of enthusiasm for bombing Libya in the beginning. His Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, said it's not part of a U.S. vital interest. And yet there again, he was beaten up by the media, and Hillary Clinton and others were demanding it. And he just sort of signed off on it. In other words, sort of a cavalier agreement to go to war because of political opportunism. He didn't have to do it. Ted Rall, go ahead.
In my view, it's both. They're both true. I mean, yes, he has some some wiggle room. The president is always influential. You can certainly tell the note the difference between an activist president like George W. Bush, who managed to change significantly previous American practice on, for example, the official legalization of torture, the elimination of habeas corpus, and so on. But presidents can only operate within a sort of limited bandwidth that's constrained by their need to conform to the corporate powers that be, the campaign donors, and the broad system as a whole. So if you look at it kind of like a mathematical limit question, you know, if I'm elected president tomorrow, can I go in and institute socialized medicine and pull all U.S. troops out of all foreign bases around the world? No, because somehow I'm going to end up getting, I don't know, impeached, assassinated, fall to scandal.
On that basis, I mean, President Roosevelt didn't have to go ahead with unemployment insurance. He didn't have to go along with Social Security. There was a lot of opposition. LBJ, there was a boycott and a filibuster in Congress against both Medicare and the Civil Rights Act in 1964. I mean, leadership, of course, it's constrained, it's limited, but it's not nothing. Peter Lavelle, go ahead.
I think, you know, we may be talking about apples and oranges here. The national security state, since the end of the Second World War, and particularly since the end of the Cold War, its strength and roots have grown exponentially. And go back with something what Jeremy had to say. Well, look what's happening with the Syria policy. And I've asked this repeatedly on my program. Who do you believe? The State Department? The Pentagon? The CIA? Who do you believe? And what has happened here is it looks patently obvious to me that Ashton Carter and his ilk have just gone around Obama. They sabotaged Kerry's own ceasefire in Syria. So the power of this president, I don't know if we should talk about the presidency, but the power of this president, he's just outmaneuvered when they can do it. And there seems to be no downside whatsoever. Look what, you know, the general that was in Afghanistan. I mean, the contempt a lot of these people that have for the president, and they just do what they want to do anyway.
That's Peter Lavelle. As JFK said during the October missile crisis, the military is mad, and he wasn't joking. A lot of them were ready to go to thermonuclear war with the USSR. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We are joined from Moscow by Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk, and from Tulsa by Jeremy Kuzmarov, a professor of American history at the University of Tulsa, whose latest book is Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century, and by award-winning editorial cartoonist Ted Rawl. We're talking about President Obama's final speech to the United Nations. Peter Lavelle, I don't know if you caught this part of the speech, but when President Obama was talking about the former Soviet republics, he said, where countries have embraced democracy and open markets, like in the Baltics or like Poland, you can see the tremendous advance in society. And then he went on to talk about how wonderful things were going to be in Ukraine. He talked about the protest movement in Maidan was not some international conspiracy, but the yearning of Ukrainian people to breathe free from the rule of oligarchs. But that's what Ukraine is. I mean, and Ukraine is a basket case. I mean, why is President Obama doing the full embrace of Ukraine under the conditions where the new government has led to civil war, where it's bombing its own people in the eastern and southern parts of the country?
It's clear to me that he can't admit a mistake. Look what Victoria Nuland did. I mean, so much of this material is so open in public and smart people discuss it, even if they disagree. That shows, again, this detachment. And he is not going to take responsibility for what his administration has done. And what it has done in Ukraine, it is fastly turning it into a failed state. Look what's happening in the Baltic states. It's amazing how Russia apparently is threatening the Baltic states. But you know what, Brian? You know what, gentlemen? People of the Baltic states are leaving the Baltic states because of a failed economic order. It doesn't work for them. And they're looking for work elsewhere. There's high unemployment. I mean, the biggest threat to the Baltic republics is their economic system that they have been coerced and pushed upon by the World Bank, the IMF, and the mantra that comes out of the Washington consensus. And one more thing about Ukraine, I mean, talking about a democratic Ukraine, when you outlaw the Communist Party, when you outlaw the other opposition parties that were in the East, you outlaw them. So you get the result that you want. That's just like the European Union, isn't it? If you don't get the right result, you just keep voting over and over again until you get what you want. And you use threats all the time. Obama's commentary on Ukraine is an abomination, considering what has happened. 10,000 people are dead in that conflict. There's still a food blockade against the Donbass. They're still experiencing shelling. All three of you guys are in the U.S. I'm sure you don't hear about that on a regular basis. I hear about it every single day it happens.
Yeah, we don't hear about it at all. That's the truth. It's not really in the media. One thing, Jeremy Kuzmarov, that President Obama said, he said, well, if all the money that had been spent on the Iraq war had been done for useful purposes, it would have made a lot of progress. Of course, the United States spent $2 to $4 trillion on the Iraq war, the occupation. 1 million Iraqis are dead. 5 million were made into refugees. He says that, you know, he's sort of reflecting, he's lamenting on the decision about Iraq. But Hillary Clinton was all for the Iraq war. She didn't have to do it. It wasn't forced on her. She was a senator from the state of New York, a liberal state. But she embraced George W. Bush's war in Iraq. And President Obama is going to leave the UN and go out on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton. No accountability.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, Obama didn't have to, you know, keep the military budget at $500 billion per year. That's the official budget. So, I mean, if he's talking about where money could be spent, I think why didn't he do more to take some of that money used for the military to invest it in our communities where we need it? And I think, yeah, we also see that what you're discussing before, the free market system and neoliberalism is failing here domestically. And that's why you had such strong support for Bernie Sanders. And, you know, people are turning to Trump. Some of them are people living under severe economic hardship and are, hearing Trump's nativist message, but also what he's saying about free trade. So I think that the free market system is failing at home as well. But I think, yeah, it is, you know, Obama could have done a lot more to use, you know, take money from the huge military budget.
Well, Ted Rall, let's talk about the military budget and another part of President Obama's speech, which was he again said we have to get rid of nuclear weapons. The scourge of nuclear weapons is something bad. He saluted himself and the other countries who signed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Agreement. He also said then in his speech, he said, well, and also the countries like our country, like the United States, which have nuclear weapons, have a responsibility to contract their nuclear stockpile. Well, actually, according to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which is signed into the law as a treaty and thus is the highest law of the land in the United States, according to the U.S. Constitution, countries like the United States have absolute affirmative obligation to get rid of nuclear weapons. That's the quid pro quo for the countries that are not going to acquire them. But President Obama actually is modernizing the nuclear weapon stockpile. He's modernizing the B-61. He's bringing into existence the so-called smart nuke with adjustable yields in a way that makes the use of nuclear weapons more likely, not less likely. I mean, isn't that the ultimate hypocrisy on this, like a fundamental question, nuclear weapons?
Yeah, it sure is. And I've always wondered who exactly appointed the United States the arbiter of which country is allowed to possess nuclear weapons in the first place. A cynic can't help looking at this and wondering if the United States at least is willing to pay lip service to nuclear de-escalation, or at least in name only, just if for no other reason than the fact that upstart nations like North Korea are starting to acquire them, and the huge advantage that the United States had with just a handful of other countries for so long is now appears to be going away. So now that other countries and small countries and poor countries like North Korea are catching on, hey, maybe those are now bad weapons. So we are going to focus more on cyber warfare and drones and other areas in which we have an advantage. Oh, until other countries catch up, in which case those will become bad weapons that need to be banned.
Peter Lavelle.
Brian, another important point here, and I'm glad you brought up the U.S. nuclear posture, because with the upgrade of American nuclear weapons, it's forcing Russia to do exactly the same thing. We should be working in the other direction. Because of the rhetoric coming out of Washington, very harsh rhetoric, towards Russia. Russia has no other choice because that's what it has to defend itself. It's nuclear deterrent. And believe me, Vladimir Putin would love to spend more money on other things than having to spend it on that. But they have to do it for defense purposes. And I wanted to say one thing to Jeremy. I agree with about the military budget, but the official military budget in the United States does not include military conflicts abroad. That is a different budget. So what we see there is a fiction. It's an absolute fiction. The ongoing wars are not accounted for in that budget.
And there's many other parts of the military budget that are not included in that budget. The real military spending is about $1 trillion a year. Go ahead.
Yeah, and let's not forget debt service on old wars. That's a huge part of the federal budget.
That was Ted Rall. In fact, 25 cents out of 50 cents out of every dollar in U.S. discretionary spending, that is the amount that's not allocated for entitlements, 50 cents out of every dollar goes either for war weapons or the debt service on past wars. Those are the actual stats. It is not a welfare state. It is a warfare state.
We should also talk about foreign aid. For example, the recent package to Israel, you know, which I believe was around the $40 to $50 billion mark for the next 10 years. That's frankly part of the war budget as well.
Yeah. And also Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government, which obviously tried to disrupt and destroy Obama's foreign policy, including the Joint Comprehensive Plan, the nuclear arms agreement with Iran. They complained that Obama did not give them enough, even though it was $40 billion over the next 10 years.
And Lindsey Graham is going to make sure that in the next Congress it's even more money.
Indeed. That we know. We don't have a crystal ball, but we're actually going to be able to make predictions like that one. And we know it will, in fact, be true. I do want to mention something else about nuclear weapons, because President Obama, in his speech, talked about Korea. I thought it was a gratuitous intervention on Korea. He said the Republic of Korea is doing great, but North Korea is just a wasteland. Now, of course, the United States is carrying out military exercises that simulate the destruction, the invasion and destruction of the DPRK. When George W. Bush declared that the DPRK, North Korea, was part of the axis of evil along with Iraq and Iran, and then proceeded to prepare to invade Iraq, North Korea suspended its participation in the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and said, okay, we're going to get nuclear weapons. Now, obviously, North Korea, like most developing countries, would want good relations, not bad relations with the United States. But President Obama at this time, at his last speech at the UN, just signaling that North Korea is a wasteland, which, you know, you can say whatever you want about North Korea, but if you've been to Pyongyang, it doesn't look like a wasteland, especially by third world standards. That's just a provocation. Go ahead, Peter.
We can look at the term wasteland. It's the most sanctioned country in the world, okay? I wonder why they have economic difficulties, and that is not an excuse for the regime in North Korea. But, you know, North Koreans, they watch the world. There was a nuclear program in Iraq and it was dissolved. And so you get invaded. Libya did the same thing. They got rid of their nuclear program and they were invaded and destroyed. I mean, you don't have to be a PhD sitting in North Korea wondering, maybe we should use this as leverage. I mean, the most important thing that can be done, what do the North Koreans want? I mean, it's very simple. They want a peace agreement with the United States to end the Korean War, and the U.S. won't do it. I mean, again, where is the common sense in all of this? Just do it and start ending that. And the isolation of North Korea could engender a more integration into the region, and we can slowly but surely have the one of the most dangerous hotlines or military lines in the world cool down considerably, because what they want is engagement. Engage them.
Yeah, Jeremy, go ahead.
No, I want, because I just published an essay on the Korean War. So the term wasteland, yeah, would be an insult to North Koreans, or somewhat ironic, because the U.S. turned North Korea into a wasteland in the Korean War. It was one of the most heavily bombed countries in world history. Most of the major cities were destroyed. So, you know, this kind of rhetoric is just going to fuel their anger, and they have legitimate historical grievances against the United States and a legitimate fear of being turned into a wasteland again, which is, I think, what explains a lot of their behavior in the world. So, yeah, I just find it ironic, that term, in light of the fact that North Korea was a wasteland because of U.S. bombing in World War II. And that shapes the psyche of the regime and people up to the present day.
That's Jeremy Kuzmarov. Jeremy, I want to thank you for that, because you can't overstate the impact of the U.S. and its allied nations bombing Korea between 1950 and 1953. And you are totally right. It was made into a wasteland. It's the height of insensitivity by President Obama to use that language. The main complaint by U.S. pilots by 1951, that was in the first year after 1 year of the war, and it went on 3 years. The main complaint of U.S. pilots is there was nothing left to bomb. Not one structure taller than one story high still existed in North Korea. And the North Koreans rebuilt their country with aid from Soviet Union and China and a lot of hard work afterwards. But you're right. I mean, it was a wasteland. That's real. I mean, you can't sort of diminish that from a country's psyche. Ted Rall, let me go back on another issue again. If President Obama says at the end, we have to stand together against intolerance and religious extremism, talk about why the world has been sort of transformed into what Osama bin Laden was hoping for during the 9/11 attacks, which was the clash of civilizations. I mean, talk about the intertangling of U.S. foreign policy with the rise of this kind of ideology, which, frankly, 30 years ago was a minor factor, if a factor at all, in global politics or even in Middle Eastern politics.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious that if you are running, depending on your point of view, a resistance organization or a terrorist organization from the vantage point of a nation state that opposes you, you are engaged in asymmetric warfare. And your biggest enemy is not really your main adversary. Your biggest enemy is apathy among people who should be your allies, fence sitters, moderates within your midst. So if you're running a radical Islamist organization like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, you need to radicalize moderate Muslims, and you need to expose the West, the United States, Israel, your enemies as the monsters that you say they are. And that's the main purpose of attacks like 9/11, in order to provoke an overreaction. You know, I've been asked since 9/11 countless times by interviewers what I would have done as president. And I always say the same thing. And I usually get laughed at by corporate media interviewers when I say I would kill them with kindness. The one thing you don't want to do is bomb anyone or assassinate anyone. You want to ask what you can do better. If your goal is really to abolish terrorism, if your goal is to abolish an asymmetrical resistance organization, then what you want to do is get rid of their main political complaint.
That's Ted Rall. We have exactly 1 minute and 45 seconds. I want to get each of you to speak for about 25 seconds. How will President Obama be remembered? This was his last speech at the UN. First, Peter Lavelle.
Well, I suppose I'll give my answer in a rather sarcastic way. Most people, depending on the next president, probably will forget Barack Obama was president. And he may go down in history as the transgender toilet man.
Okay, that was sarcastic. Jeremy Kuzmarov, go ahead.
Well, he was the first black president. That is a great accomplishment. But in foreign affairs, I think I'll defer to Oliver Stone in their chapter, refer to it as managing a wounded empire, which I think is what he's done. And he has given it a nice gloss, but he's done a lot of dirty things synonymous with empires.
Okay. And Ted Rall, again, Obama came in, the euphoric crowds along the inaugural parade route. I was there, 3 million people. They thought not only was Bush leaving, but the Bush era was ending. Has Obama ended the Bush era?
We've gone from A to F. Nobel Peace Prize 2009, wanted to close Guantanamo, all these, you know, speech to Cairo. Here we are 8 years later. We've got Guantanamo still open, more wars than ever. Iraq and Afghanistan still going. Syria and Libya, more to come, ISIS, blah, blah, blah. Now it's just getting worse and worse.
Yes, and we'll see if President Obama is able to jam through a lame duck session in Congress following the election, not before the election, the TPP, the corporatization of all things, and especially the American domination of all things in the world economy. We are completely out of time. We've been talking about President Obama's final speech to the UN. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.